Buddhist Summer School, Thursday afternoon, 2nd September 1982. Well, I'll say it again. Venerable Sirs, Venerable Lady, I would like to start today by reading from the Anguttara Nikaya, the first volume. Monks, says the Buddha, there are these two companies. What two? The company trained in bluster, not in discussion by inquiry. And I expect the word discussion here does not mean argumentativeness, but the proper type of conversation, the exchange of carefully thought out ideas. And the company trained in inquiry, not in bluster. So we have the two companies, the blustering company and the company trained in inquiry. And what, monks, is the company trained in bluster? Herein, in whatsoever company the monks listen, not to the discourses uttered by the Tathagata, discourses deep and deep in meaning, transcendental, dealing with the void when they are recited. And he goes on in that strain. And what, monks, is the company trained in inquiry, not trained in bluster? Herein, monks, in whatsoever company the monks listen, not to those discourses made by poets and other talkers, but to those uttered by the Tathagata. And having mastered that teaching, question each other about it, open up discussion thus. What is this? What is the meaning of this? When such open up the unrevealed, explain the unexplained, and dispel doubts on diverse doubtful points of doctrine, such a company is called trained in inquiry, not in bluster. Now, last Saturday, we started by the inquiry, why do we turn to religion? And I suggested that each one of us think over it carefully. What makes us take to religion? And what makes us change from the religion in which we are born to Buddhism? I hope you have had the opportunity to consider that carefully and have profited by your own meditations about it. Now, I also said last Saturday that religion for most people in the world means accepting particular creeds, having a system of ritual and ceremony and prayers of praise, devotion, petitionary prayers, intercessionary prayers, and so on. Now, as an example, I read the Christian creed. We believe in God, we believe in the Father, Almighty God, maker of heaven and earth, and all things visible and invisible, etc. And today, I would like to start by quoting from St. John's Gospel. Rather nice to start with quoting the Buddha's successor 5 centuries later. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Now, we have been talking a little bit about the meaning of the Word, the creative Word, and so forth. And we saw, or at least I hope we saw, that the Word represents that activity of creative energy, the primordial, undifferentiated creative energy, which through the operation of its particular aspect as mind, which is the formative power, releases a cosmos out of chaos. And I think I pointed out twice during this week that in the Trismegistic writings, which, remember, are derived originally from Egypt, and the Trismegistic writings under the name of Hermes Trismegistus are the Hellenized form, the Greek form, of those old Egyptian teachings, in which God is described as God, All-Father Mind. Now, of course, for me, this ties up very much with Buddhism. Mind takes a predominant place in their concept of God. Jesus refers to his Father in heaven. Abba is the name for Father. And Abba, as far as I can make out, fundamentally means the son of the unknown. The son of the unknown, Abba. And heaven refers to the Kabbalistic presentation, Chochmah, which is mind. So it's all really very interesting. I mention these things because of the Buddha using the word transcendental. I'm assuming that the translation transcendental is the correct translation of the Buddha's actual words. Now, the very first verse of Genesis in the English language is a mistranslation. The Hebrew goes, Bereshit bara Elohim. And we have translated it into English as, in the beginning God made. Elohim is God. But this is a mistranslation, because bara is not just the past tense, made, but it is the part of speech. It means got created. And Bereshit really means out of the unknown origin got created Elohim, which puts the idea of God as a personal entity quite out of the picture. And this is something transcendental altogether. So this aspect of the transcendental is something which needs careful consideration and understanding as far as we human beings are capable of understanding such things. When I use the phrase, the one primordial, undifferentiated, creative energy, I am not using the word energy in the sense in which science uses the word energy. Science knows of the different forms of energy, electrical, magnetic, chemical, gravitational, and so forth. Science knows all that. But this primordial, undifferentiated energy belongs to a transcendental context altogether. And there are several series of emanations before we come to the particular octave of emanation, which is the octave which science can deal with and knows about. So now, let me go back to this statement, the Word. again from the Trismegistic writings, the thought in the mind of God in the Hellenistic form is logos. The thought in the mind of God is logos. And that is the word, and it is a creative word. Now we know that words as we understand them and know them create nothing whatsoever. The word therefore refers to a creative energy. It is important to understand this. Because our words are words of convenience. They are symbolical sounds to represent objects, things, persons, and relationships between all these things. And all this belongs to the realm of the mortal, not to the realm of the perfected. The Samasambodhi state is something entirely different. It's a transcendental state. It starts that other octave which is profounder and greater than the octave which we can deal with. I use the word octave in the ordinary musical sense, just as on a piano you have 7 octaves or 7 1/4 octaves, as the case may be. Similarly, we may think in terms of various octaves of creation. And you remember, in the Christian creed, the Almighty God, the maker of all things visible and invisible. Visible, I take it, meaning experienceable, investigatable, in our way and in our terms. But the invisible is totally beyond all that. So now, let us consider our languages, our speech. Our speech faculty is extremely important, of course. It plays perhaps the greatest part in the lives of all human beings. All communication between man and man basically takes place in terms of speech, in terms of words. Now let us see what the Buddha says in this connection. In the Ariya Pariyesana Sutta, Ananda brings the Buddha to the eastern porch of the hermitage of the Brahman Rammaka. As usual, with his extraordinary courtesy, because he can hear conversation going on inside, he waits until the conversation has ceased. Then he gives a little cough to announce the presence of another person, and then knocks at the door. And then the monks open the door, and he goes in and sits down. You know, these things are well worth meditating on, this extraordinary courtesy of the Supreme One to all the others. And then he says, as you were sitting down just now, what was your talk about, monks? What was your talk that was interrupted? He didn't interrupt the talk, actually. When there was silence in the room, then only he went in. But yet, he treats it in this manner. Lord, our talk that was interrupted was about the Lord himself. Then he arrived. And the Buddha says, it were good, monks, that when young men of family such as you, who have gone forth from home into homelessness, out of faith, are gathered together, that you talk about Dhamma. When you are gathered together, monks, there are 2 things to be done. Either talk about Dhamma or the Aryan silence. I wonder how many people in the world, and even in the Buddhist fold, and there are a few hundred millions in the Buddhist fold, how many Buddhists appreciate the importance of silence? Either talk about Dhamma or the Aryan silence. What do human beings talk about? Well, you know all about that. Their chatter is an extraordinary intrusion upon life in its deep and real sense. So there is no coming to fruition as human beings ultimately. If, on the other hand, all talk were restricted to talk on Dhamma, the ordinary affairs of the world couldn't possibly get along. The political world, the economic world, the social world, the educational world, education in our ordinary sense of the word, all that would be whittled down to a remarkable minimum, and probably all to the good. So now, this thing about speech. The Buddha teaches, abstain from all speech that is lying, slanderous, harsh, or rude, from all frivolous talk and vain or low conversation, from all wrangling disputation. Very important, from all wrangling disputation. From all speech that is tricky, deceptive patter, and from droning out holy words for pay. These are his exact words. Droning out holy words for pay. Of course, he was hitting hard at the sort of Vedic practice which had degenerated so considerably. All speech must be truthful, blameless, pleasant to the ear, lovely, reaching to the heart, refined or polished, dealing essentially with living religiously, deep, in season, and meaningful. In season. We all know what happens in a gathering where somebody comes along and the particular bee in his bonnet goes buzzing at everybody, and everybody more or less fades away into silence while she holds forth. Deep in season and meaningful. The speaker must be faithful, trustworthy, a man of his word, a reconciler of those who are divided, an encourager of friendship, a peacemaker, an ardent lover of peace whose words make for peace. In the full account in the Brahmajala Sutta, he speaks of himself and says he is impassioned for peace. Now that is an extraordinarily strong statement by him, impassioned for peace. That is the kind of speech he recommends. Shall I put it just that way? Now, there is an interesting Hindu teaching in connection with speech. If what is to be said is truthful, kind, and useful, then say it. If it is not, silence is best. Meister Eckhart writes, "The godly man that is to say, the man who is treading the path, of course in the Christian sense, talks readily only about God. Talks readily only about God. And St. Teresa says, how can your tongues be better employed when you are together than in praising God, who has given us so much cause for it? And of course, the Buddha strenuously upheld the Aryan silence. If speech there must be, let it be about Dhamma. Mindfulness about speech, therefore, is extremely important, because speech has a tremendous influence in our life. All our knowledge, all our interchange about things, our business, everything necessitates speech all the time. So speech is something of the utmost importance. Again, this ties up with what goes on in our fantasy life. You know, our fantasies, daydreams and fantasies, are all in terms of speech, silent speech. Be extremely mindful about those fantasies. They are a wonderful revelation of what we ourselves actually are. They will show us all our defects, all our strong points too. But do remember that all daydreams and fantasies revolve round the ego. You will find yourself talking in terms of I all the time with your fantasies, whatever they are. And the fantasies will reveal to what an extraordinary degree greed, malevolence, and illusions and delusions play their part. And most of those fantasies are for the satisfaction of our egoism and our vanity, and so forth. Similarly, when we are asleep and we dream, it's an extraordinary thing, isn't it? That if you remember the dream and relate it, the word I will come in probably 3 times in any long sentence. And you are always the hero of your dream, or sometimes you are the victim. But usually you are the hero of your dream. I said to him, I told him, and so on. So the fantasies for lust for power, possessions, sex, personal superiority, success, and for putting the world right. And we pat ourselves on the back, thinking that we are very altruistic and lovers of humanity when we have our fantasies about putting the world right. Be very, very careful of all that. I can't put the world right. The world will right itself if and when I as the existential being, am able to put myself right. And this is very important. As one watches this ceaseless silent chatter, which is speech diseased, we can appreciate the vast area of the life process covered by it. And one sees with increasing clarity the evil in the heart and the immaturity of the mind. So now silence becomes very, very important indeed. There is, of course, the outward silence, keeping quiet, not speaking aloud, and letting all the others talk away. There is also another silence. When we are silent with our tongues, is our brain silent? This is the important thing. The brain is always chattering back at whatever one hears, whatever one sees, tastes, touches, smells. The brain is always talking back. You watch your daily process, whether you are going to business or in your shop or business or whatever it is, whether you are doing this, that or that, whatever it is, you notice. The brain is never silent. And the chatter of the silent chatter of the brain, I should say here, the inaudible chatter of the brain revolves around oneself all the time, and it reveals, if you can observe, really observe it with perfect mindfulness, you will find that it reveals all our good points, and they are not many on the whole, but it certainly reveals all the defilements that we have to deal with in our everyday existential life. That is why this mindfulness over in connection with audible speech and inaudible speech, with both types of speech, is of the utmost importance. As and when, through the mindfulness, constant mindfulness, and the contemplative, meditative disciplines as such, which will at first be in terms of discursive meditation. After all, when you learn meditation and all that, you are taught a certain ritual. Take for instance the Brahma Viharas. May all beings in the East be happy in the West and all that. Well, what are you doing? Your brain is talking, saying certain words. If at the same time there is a powerful, deep feeling within, right in the heart, those words will stimulate that feeling to flow out. And the feeling is shapeless, formless, and devoid of words. Then that has some sort of real effect. Otherwise, we just go through a verbal ritual, exactly as when people in the world say their prayers. It's just a verbal ritual. There is no power, no creative energy involved in it at all. It's really a waste of time. But perhaps it's better to waste time that way than in so many other ways. So now, when you come to the point where really you can go deeply into your own mental process as such, and you are in what they call what is called the second jhana, and this is in the Upanishads you have it as the sushupti state. You see, when you are in that state, the flow of words has ceased. The flow of discursive thought has completely stopped. Now, discursive thought is a string of words, and as we have all seen before too, words represent things, persons, actions, relationships and so forth, all belonging to the sphere of mortality, the realm of the Lord of Death, because it begins, proceeds, perishes. The next thought or mood begins, perishes, proceeds and perishes. Now, when you are in proper concentrated activity, concentration of mind, you are aware of this process, you're conscious in the mode of mortality. Now, when that flow stops, but you are fully alert, conscious, awake, clearly conscious, the words which the Buddha uses so frequently, in what manner are you conscious? You are not conscious anymore in the mode of mortality. Because words, the vehicles of mortality, have ceased. But you are fully awake, you are fully aware, but in what manner are you aware? You are aware in the manner in which nothing arises, proceeds and ends, which is the deathless mode. And with the first stage of the stopping, of the ending of the flow of discursive thought, you get your, I call that the movement through the first portal of death. Whilst you are alive, you know death to that extent whilst you are still alive here. As the process deepens, at the end of the fourth jhana, you go through what I call the second portal of death, where there is the complete cessation of all sensory impressions and so forth. So all our criteria and standards and ideas and so forth, they all cease there. And then the Buddha teaches that you enter the infinity of Akasha. And for my part, I rather feel that and what is generally given as the next state, the infinity of vijnana, of consciousness, are really a simultaneous thing. Because Akasha is a strange word. It's very difficult to translate into English. It is usually translated as space and also as the sky. But the kash part in Akasha means to shine. That's its meaning. Space doesn't shine as such, as far as we know, or does it? Any physicists here can inform me? Well, it's the shining state. And this is very important. The word we use is shining, but what it actually means is probably a condition of enlightenment. You are awake, you are alert, you are quite sensitive, you see, all the time. But you are sensitive to a transcendental level of existence. You're sensitive to the void. This void, which is a plenitude at its own transcendental level and is utterly beyond the plenitude which we experience and see and know as our universe. But this is a deeper state of the realization of deathlessness. I think it was yesterday, wasn't it, that I mentioned the Buddha saying that if your mindfulness upon the body enables you to win all the states till right up till the realization of the deathless. Now, the word realization means making real. But of course, the word real is related to res, Latin res, meaning a thing. But there are no things in this context. The realization means making them entirely factual. So it is not imagination. If it were imagination, you will soon find, supposing you think that you are in that state, and when you'll wake up out of it and discover it wasn't, it was real in the material sense, not in the transcendental sense. The reality in the transcendental sense is something different. And the word Akasha contains within it that sort of implication. That is as far as I am aware. I may be quite wrong. I don't know. So that is the second, you've passed through the second portal of death. And then as the states deepen, you enter upon and abide in the state of nothing, as it is usually said. But put it this way, no thing, hyphenate no and thing, which is the state of the no thing. And if it is the state of the no thing, which is something perishable, it refers probably, possibly, to that transcendental condition where primordial creative energy functions. See, this starts off the next octave of our being as such. And after the no-thing, there is the state of neither perception nor non-perception. But do realize that perception in this context does not mean what we understand by perception. All that we understand by perception is in terms of the use of our senses, and the impression, the sense impressions are dealt with by the logical processes of the brain. The brain only talks in relation to the sense impressions and makes a meaningful concept, meaningful at our mortal level. So you see, this perception is a transcendental perception altogether. I mentioned yesterday in the latter part of the meeting the subtle senses which the Sankhya philosophy talked about. The subtle senses. It's something perhaps to do with that. And then the Buddha talks about the final state, the cessation of all perception and feeling. But the cessation there is not the cessation of what we at our mortal level experience as perception and feeling. Because we have already passed that with the second jhana. We have already passed that. That's why I find it convenient to put it in these terms. The first death, the second death, and then this, the third death. Whilst you are alive as an existential being. So this is the experiencing of, if we use the positive word, of immortality. Because it is in that mode of awareness that you function, with the cessation of that transcendental perception and transcendental feeling as such. So one understands, or perhaps one may hope to understand, that immortality has no relationship with a perpetuation in time, and certainly not in space. You see, we all think of immortality as identical with eternity. That it is identical with eternity, but we think of eternity the wrong way. We think of it as the opposite of time. And many people identify eternity with timelessness. Now, I feel that that is not correct. Because timelessness is a human experience. Whether the human being is you or me, or whether it is a Buddha. Timelessness starts as and when the Buddha or you or I can enter these very profound states. All right? And then, after such and such a period of time, we have to come out of that state because the body demands it. And you cannot deny the demand of the body to wake up. That is to say, in fact, you are awake in that state in the reality, but you come down back to sense and brain functioning. Because the body is the body, therefore you have to come down out of that transcendental condition into this condition. In that condition, you are in the condition of revelation. Revelation is rooted in the spaceless and timeless infinity of the eternal silence. That's what revelation is rooted in. So you come back to this state. Now, the Buddha says that he can stay 7 days in this timeless condition. But the timeless condition, as he himself declared, lasts 7 days. So it is still within the confines of time, in a sense. Because time determines when you have entered that state, time determines when you come out of that state, as such. But I would say that eternity has a meaning which I must say is quite indescribable. I can't say anything about it in words. Eternity subsumes both time and timelessness. Eternity belongs to that transcendental condition which is associated with the primordial, undifferentiated, creative energy. And the action which takes place there, which is the fundamental primordial action as such, the first karma, the creative thing, the creative act, it's a creative action in eternity. And I said first, but that is a misleading way of talking. There is no first, second or last under those conditions. Because in the sphere of the infinite, the eternal and the immortal, there is only immediacy. There is no measurement. There are no quantities. There is no otherness. This is the mystery, the unpierceable mystery. And yet I say these words because somehow it has come to me this way. You see, you can get the feel of it, just to get the feel of it, if somehow or other the sense of transcendence has begun to thrill in your existential being. Now you may say, well, all this airy-fairy stuff, what is the use of it? I mean, I'm not there, I can't do anything with it, and so forth. True. But if you get just this, what we would commonly call a momentary touch, but this momentariness has all the power and marvel of eternity involved in it. If you get it just like that for that instant, it will change your life for the rest of your days. You will be able to drop so much which is unnecessary in life. And you won't have to sort of say to yourself, oh, I must get rid of this. This is not required, so I must give it away. And so forth, you see. I have known friends come to me and tell me throughout the years, I'm going to give up the world. But you haven't got the world. You've just got your own self and your own little house and your little property and whatnot, and you're living in that. What are you giving up? This is the sort of absurdity that besets so many people. You don't have to give up anything. That eternity completely subsumes everything. But when that touch of transcendence enables the defilements, which are like scabs and pimples and goodness knows what not on the psyche, they just drop off. Because this touch of the transcendence is a healing power from within. You don't have to take an external medicine in order to realize this. It is a healing power from within which is generated. And it's an extremely powerful energy. Extremely powerful. That is one of the reasons why the abstemious life, the simple life, is so essential in order that the psychophysical organism will stand that tremendous voltage. You know, it's a fact that so many people who take to yoga and the various religious disciplines and in the contemplative orders and so forth, they go mad. They get nervous breakdowns. And sometimes they commit suicide and so forth. These are facts, you see. So you have to have a psychophysical organism which will stand that voltage. And one of the most important factors which will enable you to stand that voltage is silence. Be quiet. Because then the quietness, which starts first with the quietness of the tongue and then reaches out to the quietness of the brain, gives you, sensitizes you in the right way. And it also transforms the organism in such a way, I can't explain how or why, but I believe it does. It transforms the organism in such a way that transcendent energies don't knock you down with a feather. It enlightens you. It gives you an extraordinary power from within yourself to deal with so many troubles, so many difficulties, so much opposition and so forth. And you see, this is spiritual. Perhaps I better say psycho-mental strength. Psycho-mental, not psycho-physical. Psycho-mental strength. Strength which never hurts or oppresses anybody or anything whatsoever. And the strength is of the nature of infinite resilience. I can easily give you a good physical analogy. Take your carving knife, if you have a carving knife, or your sword or something, and slash the air. Wave your sword up and down in space. Do you think you can cut out any slabs of space? You can't, isn't it? It's infinitely resilient. The little notices we have on the roadway sometimes, give way, let the other pass first, give way. Yes, give way infinitely if you can. Being whole, healthy, holy, emanates such an extraordinary influence around you that harm won't come to you. Oh, I wish I had brought down the second volume, which contains the account of Angulimala, that murderous robber, meeting the Buddha. I think I can give just the simple essentials of it. The story is like this. Angulimala is a murderous robber who is the terror of the countryside. Even King Pasenadi himself, the Kosalan king in whose kingdom Angulimala flourished, was afraid of that man. He used to kill travelers who went through the region where he lived. And he wore a garland of their fingers, which he cut off, you see, and added to his garland and made it longer and longer. Anguli is a finger, Mala is a garland, you see. So that's why he was named Angulimala. Now the Buddha was walking along in that region, and he was told, oh, don't go that way, because that is where Angulimala commits his crimes. The Buddha listened and steadily walked on. He just walked on. He probably foresaw Christmas Humphreys coming in our age with his walk on, you see. And so the Buddha just walked on. And Angulimala saw him coming from the distance and said to himself, "Ah, there is this shaven-headed recluse coming along. He'll be good prey for me." So he started walking, trying to catch up with the Buddha. The Buddha walked steadily on, and Angulimala found that he couldn't catch up with the Buddha. So he got rather perturbed and interested. He said, "Stop, recluse, stand still, recluse, stand still." And the Buddha answered, "I am standing still, but you are walking." And Angulimala said, "You say you are standing still and I am walking, but I can't get up with you. What is the reason for this?" He wanted to know why this happened. And then the Buddha explains in his inimitable, magical, quiet way, "I do not slay creatures. I am standing still." And Angulimala gets very impressed with this. "Whereas you are a robber, you take what is not given to you freely and you kill the living creatures." So Angulimala gets very interested and inquires further, and of course the Buddha teaches him in the usual way and so forth, and Angulimala asks to be accepted as a monk, and the Buddha accepts him. And Angulimala was so earnest and so steady with his discipline and so forth that he really became a saint. Later on, King Pasenadi came to visit the Buddha. And the first thing the king does is to bow down and kiss his feet and stroke his feet. And he was very much afraid of Angulimala. He didn't know what had happened to him. When King Pasenadi came, Angulimala was sitting close by in his robes. And the talk turned upon Angulimala. And the king said that, "I can't do anything with sword or stick in connection with this man. He's such a terrible menace." And the Buddha says, "Would you like to see him?" And the king said, "Yes, yes." And the Buddha said, "There he sits," pointing to Angulimala, you see. And the account in the discourse goes on that King Pasenadi's hair stood up on his head because he was so terrified at the idea. He looked at him. And then he discovered that this man was a perfected one, an arahant actually. He reached arahantship through the teaching of the Buddha and through the Buddha's extraordinary influence. It was the extraordinary influence of one who had realized transcendence. He who can enter that state of the stopping of all feeling and perception is functioning consciously in the transcendental octave, so to say. And that emanates a power which science and we do not know. So you see, the world benefits by all this airy-fairy stuff, all the time. Whoever is purified is like the sun. He radiates all that energy which purifies and heals. So this is a story which is of very great importance. What is the time?
20 past.
My watch has stopped.
25 past.
Well now, there were one or two things I wanted to speak about, but we'll leave that now. When we go away from here, we might feel that our meeting has ended. Not so. Our meeting never began, it can never end. Right from the original creative action in eternity, which started off the entire universe of manifestation, visible and invisible, all this was in that unitary whole. And that unitary whole, I use the word decided, but you know, it's human words just don't apply, to become different, to manifest itself, you see, in order to know, see its own face, so to say. We were contained in that. And everything that has emerged, especially ever since the Big Bang, everything that has emerged was contained in that primordial unitary whole. So, out of the transcendent state, moving through star and circle solitudes, if you like, ultimately we appear on the earth as such, in our time and our space. We are not separate from each other. We are all one. And as you said, Robert, your respect and love have meant a very great deal to me. And I'm very deeply grateful to all of you for this meeting. And I'm particularly grateful to the Venerable Bhikkhus and the Venerable Lady there, you see, for gracing our meetings with their presence, which to me has been a real source of inspiration all the time that I have been talking. So it's interesting. I talk so much and say that silence is the best. But you know, life is a deliciously funny thing. There is the funny peculiar and the funny ha-ha. But there is a certain, another type of funniness, which is this delicious laughter, not the loud cacophony which sometimes explodes upon the scene, not that, but a delicious quiet laughter which, when it expresses itself in quintessence, you will see on the face of the Buddha, the smile of the Buddha. It's not the smile of the Mona Lisa, the smile of the Buddha, a totally different smile. And that smile goes out from each and every one of us to each and everyone present. And if that smile can function all through our lives, we'll have done quite a little bit, which is good. So when you go away, I hope you have had the benefit, the advantage of this beautiful place the presence of the bhikkhus and their teaching and so forth, and our meetings, and the sort of renewal, a creative renewal, I trust, which has emerged even to some degree in us. Because it is that creative renewal which is the linking agent with transcendent energy. And may it give you peace and the right sort of calm happiness, and make you all a benediction to the world in which you live. Thank you all. All right. When we talk of entering deeper states of consciousness, the terms entering and deeper give a spatial feel to the words, you see. Actually, there is no spatial movement at all. It is, I would rather put it this way, that there is an intensification of what is already there in the second jhana, and it becomes much more intense in the fourth jhana. You see, when you get the going down of all sensory perceptions, as it is said, and that happens during the fourth jhana, and the last two elements which characterized the first and second and third jhanas, they are all out. The going down of all sorrow and all joy. And there is only complete equanimity. See, that means that the mind is vibrating just there like that. It's in that state. It was this about the fourth jhana which made me speak in terms of the original meaning of chaos as a state of vibrant quiescence. Because it's alive. So, it is just that the intensity increases. Supposing you had a bulb which could take, say, 600 or 700 volts. Is that possible, Dr. Kia?
Yes, I suppose so.
Yes. Now, if it is taking a current of just 240 or 250 volts, you will get a certain intensity of brightness, won't you? Supposing you gradually increase the voltage, it will get brighter and brighter and brighter. You see? And at the full voltage that it can take, it will be an extremely bright light, won't it? So it's like that. It is a condition of enlightened consciousness, which means that it is in relationship, it is contacting transcendental states, which are non-verbal, they are non-descript, and there are no words to describe it. But you know it, not in the brain sense of knowing. The brain knows everything in terms of what I call mental card indexes. You see, just a particular pattern of words which have a meaningful content. You see, it's not that. It's rather more like this. When a youth and a maiden, for some reason or other, are coming closer together, you see, and they just sit side by side, and they just know certain things. See, that's about the closest physical human experience which is analogous to this condition. You just know. The theistic mystics say, feel like this. When they get into that condition, ah, yes, this is God here. And then when they say, and God informed me or told me this, that and the other, that is the limited human way in which they try to express the impress of the transcendent energy. You see, the psychophysical organism bears the impress of an experience of transcendent states. It bears the impress. If the person, the psychophysical person as such, has been trained in the right way, and if he has that type of intellect, sooner or later, that impress will take shape conceptually and verbally. You see? And when, if in addition he has a gift for speech, for the right sort of speech, his speech is prophetic speech then. Real prophetic speech has nothing to do with telling you what's going to happen 2.5 years later or anything like that. Prophetic speech simply means that speech which through your listening to it affects you in such a way that it enlightens you. That is prophetic speech. The word prophesy has unfortunately come to have different meanings. Look at the worldly meaning of prophecy applied to both the Buddha and Jesus. You know, the Buddha said, now that women have joined the order, you see, the Dhamma will not last for more than 500 years. But he was wrong. Hopelessly wrong. And the Christ said, some of you who are now living, you see, will see the Son of Man coming in your lifetime with trailing clouds of glory. I nearly said gory. Trailing clouds of glory, you see. Nothing of the sort happened. But the Gospels came into being, you see, and they contained a good deal of the esoteric truths. There are so many passages in the Gospels which are derived, have their Kabbalistic derivation. They knew what they were talking about.